Hello.
Hi.
Welcome
to K-Chung Radio.
The talking show.
On K-Chung Radio. I'm one of your hosts, Nicholas Miller.
Oh, hey. And I'm Steve Cato, the other host.
And we are broadcasting live from Chinatown, Los Angeles, California. We are glad to be here. It is beautiful out, sunny, great. The stars are out. Everything is perfect. You know, Steve, have you ever seen that movie, The Killing of a Chinese Bookie? Have you seen that movie?
No, I haven't seen that movie, actually. I wouldn't mind seeing it. That's Cassavetes, right? Is that... am I right? I forget.
Yeah, I think that's a really good movie. I like looking at that movie a lot. And something that gets overlooked is there's a lot of really good talking in that movie. Yeah, really great talking. Well, do you remember the talking from that movie, Steve?
No, like I said, I haven't seen that movie before, but I look forward to seeing that movie. Maybe we can watch that together?
Great stuff. Okay, well, we got a long program for you tonight, so we're going to get right into it. Here we are with Carl Andre. He's going to tell you a little bit about a lot of things. So buckle up, get ready, don't relax because this one's action-packed. Here it is.
Two pages on the wall are Quincy Index. Quincy, Massachusetts was the city of my birth and my first 16 years of life. It's a collection of words from memory, all proper nouns, as might be indexed perhaps in a book about Quincy and that what is, composes that poem. Then it goes on to the autobiography, my autobiography, which is a set of words placed upon the page in a grid, the kind of grid that a typewriter produces. These are all typewritten. The kind of grid that a typewriter produces in a very machine-like way, and each word is spaced so that the letters are evenly spaced horizontally and vertically, which is not true on a typewriter by nature. The horizontal spacing of the letters is a lot closer than the vertical spaces between the lines, but this has been compensated by making, let's say, two spaces between the letters vertically and three spaces between the letters horizontally. This continues for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages. Actually, there are other pages from this array of words which have lines like Adams, Braintree, Eastern, Herring, Kligman, Nut, Railway, Square. They're interlocking alphabetical series distributed, the letters distributed on these typewriter grids, like very much like grid paper. And that continues for 8 pages. And that's one board complete, which is 2 pages of the Quincy Index and 7 pages, including the title page of the autobiography. The next board, each board has 11 pages when they're in the vertical format, or 8 pages when they're in the horizontal format. And most of these pages are in the vertical format. And the next set are 11 pages in the vertical format, beginning with a poem which is a set of phrases from sentences all centered on the word Quincy, such as reach Braintree, Quincy I beg, friends at Quincy, Mrs. Smith, Quincy centered on the page. These phrases were taken from the letters of Abigail Adams, who was the wife of John Adams, who was the second president of the United States. The Adams family lived in what was then called Braintree, but later became Quincy, Massachusetts. John Adams was the second president, and John Quincy Adams, who I believe was the 8th president of the United States, were from that family. And so Quincy, Massachusetts, for a city in the United States, is rather more deeply steeped in history than is usual. All these poems are come from pre-existing texts, either texts, as in the case of this Quincy poem, from the letters of Abigail Adams, or from other texts, or from the text of memory itself. The autobiography was taken from memory, and the next poem of these 11 single-page poems is One Gazetteer. That's another array of words, again recalled from memory about pretty much one's hometown, or perhaps one's early years of life up to, say, the age of 20. And then the next one is RI112952900, which is a pattern of words again, or a single-page poem, which is again derived from memory, and the title, RA112952900, was my serial number in the United States Army, which I served in 1955-56. The next poem, Pope Byron Andre, is my analysis of a poem by Byron about Pope. It was actually, I don't actually remember, it was either I found it in Byron's letters or it was by Byron about Pope. And the three, Pope, Byron, Andre, the poem originally by Pope, the presentation of it by Byron, and then my analysis of the poem, alphabetical analysis. So the poem that began with Pope winds up in my analysis as A, abroad, all amphibious, asses, at. And it just continues as a alphabetical analysis of the poem, of Pope and Byron. The next one, Dirge on Montezuma Slowly, is again words taken from the range of words on an account of the conquest of Mexico by Bernal Castillo Diaz, I believe the man's name was, who was accompanied Montezuma in Mexico. That poem has the words and lines with various numbers of words in each line. The next poem, which is about the same subject, is a very dense packing of words in a, which is arranged in alphabetical order and by length of words. So you get a standing pattern of a kind of triangular lattice-shaped pattern, which is very dense. The dirge on Montezuma is not dense. The words have been selected more or less in a kind of narrative or chronological way, going from the first line, Mexico sides, before, day, parts, nothing, enough, to the last line, which is stones, arrows, places, which would more or less follow the chronology of the conquest of Mexico. But the other one begins, the dense packing one begins, our ambassadors, M, Aguayacaluco, as circumspect, and ambassadors, you can see by alphabet and by length of word, and ends, so opportunity to selfishness, up Tetzabuca, we treacherous. The next one is a color Xerox. These are all Xerox prints which have been pasted to the wall. The next one is the first color Xerox print in this series. And this one actually refers to a work that is on display at Oxford at the Museum of Modern Art called Passport. And each one of these lines is a sort of a title for each page, a description of each page, and it's in red Xerox. The whole sequence is called Visas, which is, of course, referring to Passport, which is the name of the book, which is on display at Oxford. And it begins, curtain, red writer, fat club foot, fat queen, glad handy, each phrase referring to one line. The next one page of Passport, the next one is a lyric. The exact cause of this lyric having been written, I can't really remember, but it is all four words of four letters, and no longer with varying line lengths, four words, and three words, then two words, then four words, then two words, and building on a various pattern. All of these poems represent, more than anything else, an attempt to discover forms for poems in language. As for instance, the next one is the form for three voices. It's three voices to be read words alternately from 1 to 30, so that the first line, nothing is said. The second line, no, is said, and then no is repeated for every even interval at 2, 4, 6, 8, and so forth. Then the third space, the word light is spoken, and then repeated every third space. And then on the fifth space, the word now is spoken, and then repeated every fifth space, so that finally, at the 30th line, the 2, the 3, and the 5 are all recited in the same line, so the three distinctly separate voices would be voicing their words all simultaneously. The next one is a similar work in that it's for a group of voices. In this case, the subject of the poem is the duel between Alexander Hamilton and Burr, Aaron Burr, which occurred early in the founding of the American Republic. And it's based on counting. And there is one counter who counts from 100. And then Hamilton speaks one word at a certain point, and then the counter continues the counting, and then Burr, and then various other characters. And this just continues for one page. And And finally, the last line would be correspond to 1 in the series coming back from 100 would be fire, which would, of course, would be the order to fire of the duel in which Alexander Hamilton was killed by Burr. And the last one is another Xerox. The last one on this board is another Xerox yellow and red print of a short sort of protest poem about Myrtle Avenue in Brooklyn, where I lived at one time, and where it was a ghetto area of Spanish and black people, and was a very hard life indeed for them there. That's the first two boards in the exhibition. It really has been for me, the significance of these works largely for me are various attempts to discover forms. Again, the traditional forms in English poetry, which I by no means despise, forms, the villanelle and the sonnet and so forth, actually, which are very often derived from other traditions, romantic ballad tradition and so forth, but they're all related to song and to music. And I think the classical, certainly not the heroic couplet, but the heroic couplet certainly already is beginning to be poetry that was meant to be printed and not to be sung. And for me, poetry has been largely a matter of writing and of reading and of printing, and not a matter of singing. I'm not a songster. I cannot sing myself. And although I love music very much, I'm not in any way musical. And I think our poetry has ceased to be musical. And if poetry can be described as language mapped on an extraneous art, and formerly it was language mapped on music, I think now it's language mapped on some aspect of the visual arts. I remember as a child, before I could read, I was not precocious in any way, but before I went to school and learned to read, I used to like to look at the books in the library of my family. And the books that interested me much more were the books of poetry, not because I could read them, but because the shape of the poems on the page was much more interesting than the shape of the dull gray prose, which was in solid blocks and not interesting. I used to love to look at the poems of Whitman and people of that sort of, any poem, because one could see, even without being able to read, their recurrence of form. In a sense, my work has been an attempt to derive forms that can hold material, hopefully as strong as the musical forms can hold language and classical English verse. I do not at all wish to destroy those classical forms. It's just that I myself cannot operate in them to a degree to convince myself. So I have tried to look for other forms. And the next board is taken up, the next few boards, two boards are taken up by two long series of two long poems, 15 pages each. One is about Charles Lindbergh, who was, of course, the American aviator who flew solo across the Atlantic in, I believe, 1928. And he was of interest to me because he was one of the first great media heroes in America. His fame was entirely generated through the media. And he was of Swedish ancestry, as I am. His father was born in Sweden, as my father was born in Sweden. And he had a great success as a result of this solo flight. But he evidently was a man completely unprepared for the success that he received, and in the face of personal tragedy, which was the kidnapping of his son, the famous Lindbergh kidnapping, he turned very much against the whole sort of popular social order that had caused him to become famous, and retreated more and more into isolation, and became quite sympathetic to fascist ideas, then of course very much dominant in Germany and in Italy. And he wrote with his wife a book called The Wave of the Future, in which he portrayed much of what occurred in Western society as being scum in the wave of the future, and thinking of the cleansing that was happening in Europe. I think this was more this naivete of Lindbergh. His father, in fact, had been a very strong opponent in the United States of the American entry in the First World War. And Lindbergh had been opponent to the entry of the United States into the Second World War, but for distinctly opposite reasons. Lindbergh's father had been a progressive populist member of the Congress from Minnesota before the First World War, and he thought that American entry into the First World War was only a plot by bankers and businessmen to ensure their own prosperity at the expense of the blood of Americans. Whereas Lindbergh, by the time of the Second World War, had married into a wealthy family and allied himself with bankers and industry, and really thought that perhaps the cleansing of Europe might be achieved by the Axis powers rather than... he was not sympathetic to England, and he made speeches indicating that there was Jewish control of the media in the United States, and Jews were trying to drive the United States into war with Germany. I think this was largely through a kind of lack of preparation for the role he finally came to hold. He became a kind of royalty in the United States, and you can imagine a royalty who was thrust upon, the job was thrust upon them without any preparation at all. They simply don't know when to keep their mouths shut, like most of us, I guess. But this poem is derived from lines which are not at all altered from two previous texts. One text are quotations from Lindbergh throughout his life, and the other text are quotations from the book We, which he published shortly after he made his famous transatlantic trip. So the a typical line might be, read history, you'll find that everywhere in all lands and at all, confidence in Mike Jenny with its powerful OX-5, made a mistake, was in not establishing a firing squad in the first days, storming pilot of the old days was measured to... It goes on alternating these sentences. These sentences are all, I believe, in chronological order, but they are not... these phrases, rather, or fragments, are actually printed lines from these books. They don't continue in a logical or grammatical sequence. They rather continue as they somehow present something in the text which seemed to me to carry on not necessarily the message that Lindbergh was trying to tell us, but the kind of subtext that exists in everybody's speech that really the speaker is not aware of. It's a way of analyzing a text and to discover perhaps tendencies in the text which are not immediately apparent even to the author. And so Lindbergh continues for 15 lines, rather 15 pages, the last page being, new world and the old, their welcome to will, after going aboard the Memphis, I became river and along Broadway over the Mississippi. That, of course, coincides with the ending of the book We, when he does arrive in Paris and it says his great fete in the gala, and then is brought back in triumph to New York. The next series of 15 pages is called Brown Emerson, and it is taken from two sources. One is contemporary, one are contemporary accounts of the raid of John Brown on the Harper's Ferry Armory in 1859, which was, you might say, the premonition of the Civil War in the United States, which broke out in 1860. John Brown was a fanatical abolitionist, and he raided the United States arsenal in Harper's Ferry in the hope that he could arm the slaves, the black slaves of the region, and form a kind of free republic within the United States. He had despaired of the government of the United States at that time, which was not abolitionist at all. And in fact, politically, the abolitionists were in a very weak position. Emerson, of course, is the famous transcendentalist philosopher from New England, from Cambridge and Concord in Massachusetts. And he was a great advocate of freedom, but he was in a very ambiguous position as regards the abolitionists, because he did not wish to advocate illegal actions, although at the same time he considered slavery to be illegal. His friend Henry Thoreau was much more outspoken in support of the abolitionists and in the abolitionist cause. This poem was done in the 60s, certainly, as many of these poems were, at a time exactly when intellectuals were in a position of advocating perhaps the ideals of revolutionaries, but at the same time advising them not to be quite so active in a physical and historical sense. And Emerson was exactly in that position as related to John Brown, and there was much secret support for John Brown by the transcendental gentlemen of New England. They rather secretly supported him in some cases. Emerson did not, but others did. And so what I have done is to take texts from John Brown, the account of his raid, and from Emerson's diaries or journals, and make this running list in which color is the is the most important thing. So in Brown Emerson, it begins white men, crimson cross, white men, very large, black, white men, coal, black, white man, silver bells, Blue Ridge, Greenwood, blue horizon, and silver and the gold, Blue Ridge. And it continues with words, alternating words from Brown, descriptions of John Brown's raid, and references to color in Emerson's journal, which don't at all have any necessary reference, but I have brought them together because they certainly had a historical confluence in that abolitionist struggle and ensuing. Of course, John Brown was captured and hanged before the Civil War actually began, and Emerson continued once the war began as, of course, a very strong supporter of the Union cause against the Confederacy and the ultimate abolition of slavery in the United States. But this is an event that was immediately before the Civil War in the United States. And this continues for 15 pages and ends on its 15th page. Blue recesses, Captain Brown was hung, 17 white men, sting of color, a white mist, these yellowing letters, and brown, blue sky. Again, this is an attempt to discover a form which will successfully deal with texts, and I don't say deal with them in any fair way. I don't think poetry is either fair or unfair, but somehow the confluence of Brown and Emerson, it became to me almost in a way which is impious to say, but almost in a painterly way, because it was a struggle of color and people's attitudes toward race in terms of color. And Brown was, John Brown himself, of course, a white man, and Emerson a white man. It was the question of color which caused disagreement between them and people who were sympathetic to both sides, as it still remains in the United States today, and it's, the racial problem is still there. The question of color has never been resolved at all. The next series is three pages, De Kooning, Gorky, Pollock, which is an analysis of three catalogs of their work in terms of the titles of their work and the titles they chose for their work. I know very well from my experience with painters, especially, that the titles of their work, of abstract paintings, are only casually related to the painting at all. Usually it's perhaps someone comes by, a poet or a fellow painter, and the painter has been looking for a title, and a title comes up that the painter happens to like at the time, and it has not really much application of the painting except tell one from the other. But I think all the titles of the painting taken together do kind of indicate the cast of mind of the painter through the course of his work. So I here have combined in alphabetical analysis the titles of paintings of works by De Kooning, Gorky, and Pollock. So it begins Abstraction, Acrobat, Afternoon, Afternoon, Agony, Agony, and ends, quite predictably, I think, considering these people are abstract expressionists, with woman repeated many times, and then Zorkum, Zorkum, Zogbaum, Zurich. Zorkum, Zorkum represents, is a place in Armenia, the home, original, the birthplace of Gorky, and at the end, Zogbaum was a sculptor, and Zurich, I don't really know, I must, of course, refer to the city in Switzerland. The next board begins with a short lyric. A number of these poems in the show deal with religious subjects, although I cannot say that I am a devout person or even a believer. I was raised in a sort of congregationalist church and went to Sunday school, and the texts of the Christian religion are very familiar to me, and I could not really avoid using these texts because I wanted to use texts that were would be familiar to other people. It isn't so much a new text I wanted to present, but a new form for texts which people already knew, and inevitably the religious texts are ones which I was most familiar with. In this case, it begins with a short lyric, Christ's Agony in the Garden, which is just proper names on, as they might appear on two sides of Bible paper, and it's something which cannot be read. It's an overlay, you might say, of one page on another. And then we go from that single page to Dithyram, which is a row of four columns of words. I think each column represents words taken from each of the four Gospels. One Gospel beginning star, vipers, and ending door, lightning, and another Gospel beginning child, stones, and ending night, women, and and so forth, and there are four, one for each of the Gospels. The next series of four pages, called The Animals of God, are analysis of the four Gospels, called by their symbolic names in the iconography of painting, that is, angel, lion, ox, and eagle. Eagle, I'm sure, in my memory, is St. John. Ox is St. Luke. Lion, of course, St. Mark. And angel must be Matthew. And these are analysis of the texts of those Gospels. Words selected subjectively, I must say, and repetitions selected. And those are those four pages. The next, the last on this board are five pages representing 500 terms for Charles A. Lindbergh. It's a further analysis of texts about Lindbergh and selecting words and their repetitions, again subjectively, but trying in some way to indicate through word frequency some indication of the diction that is applied to Lindbergh or Lindbergh would use himself. Of course, this whole thought of a kind of statistical analysis of texts, of dictions, that is the range of words, was really founded through biblical study. In the beginning of the 18th century with the publication of the first concordance in English through the present time, philologists have been able to differentiate the different hands in writing the various books of the Old and the New Testament by a study of the range of the words that are available, were available to each author, because each of us very distinctly has a diction in our writing and in our speech, which is the range of words that are available to us at any one time, and the ones we prefer to use as opposed to others. And this is quite distinct. It has been found that through statistical analysis of various parts of the books of the Bible, they've found that different parts of the books of the Bible have been written by different people, as well as single books being written by one person. In other cases, it's been obvious that one hand has written part of one and part of another, and they're not necessarily in any order, but are combined by historical forces that did not necessarily have to do with the individual identity of each author. And it was from biblical scholarship that this method arose, and I use it entirely in an informal way. I can't say that I am a scholar in these things at all, but I use a kind of an apparatus in my hand, used entirely subjectively, of selecting words from texts and trying to present the range, the spectrum of the words that are available in each case, of each text. Right, downstairs. Little mice on the stair. Here's another board with 11 pages, the first three pages being a rather satirical work called White Bowls. I have never been a writer of prose. I've never felt comfortable writing prose, and something that's very difficult to me. And in this one, it's a kind of pseudo-novel that is done by picking at random Russian English vocabulary flashcards and moving them from one bowl to the other bowl and reading them off. And so it's like all novels should be. It's both in Russian and in English if you choose. This, of course, is only the English version of this possibility. As it says, whenever the reader tires the simple permutations of 147 cards, he can begin to form combinations by color and language, providing himself with additional factors of 3 and 2 respectively. I wish to increase the density of my novel. I wish him luck. It's really, I think, inspired as a satire on the random methods that were widely employed in the beginning of, well, in the late 50s and 60s, John Cage and so forth, using allegedly random methods in order to compose works in music or paintings or whatever. But the irony is that any method you use to produce random results by this method automatically closes down the possibility of randomness. That random sequences are among the most difficult mathematical sequences in order to to generate, and one has to be extremely careful at every point. And I think there's a difference between randomness and a kind of steady deviation. And I think people were really looking for a steady deviation away from text or reason that they were aware of, and to produce text that they could not otherwise produce. But I think to call it random is very much a mistake, because as, what is it, Mallarmé said that one throw of the dice does not abolish the law of chance. Well, a pair of dice, of course, in itself is an extremely limiting proposition. You cannot get random results from dice at all, because dice are a very narrow cut on the possible values that can be produced. In fact, throwing dice in order to make a conclusion cuts down your range of possibilities immensely. And in a certain way, these so-called random processes that were employed were not really objectively extending possibilities, but they were limiting them, which, of course, seeking limits is what I've always tried to do, but I've never really employed random methods. This is the only use I've ever made, and it's a rather satirical one. The next one is a single-page lyric. Actually, it's just about three different kinds of ways of ordering words, and it's strictly like the page of a sketch. I think one even may have the form of a sonnet. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. I think it has 14 or 15 lines. Sonnets need not have 14 lines. But so that the shadow of old forms, sort of the scoromorph, as they say, or the shadow form of old forms of poetry do emerge in my work. The next one is another lyric, a short lyric. There's another one. My Bride, Sand Street. Then there is a 14-line sonnet, which is made of quotations from the broken quotations from the letters of Hart Crane. It's called Sonnet on a Drowned Poet, and in fact, they are fragments of the words from his letters. Begins forth through attain I, period still form, and ends comma were expression the weak dear in. In a way, it's breaking down writing style to not so much the aim to nonsense, but to a point of disintegration rather than nonsense, because toward the end of his life, his letters definitely represented a kind of disintegrating sensibility. And it's not really by mimesis that I'm trying to present that, but through, again, this business of analyzing texts. Again, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, maybe it never works, but sometimes it has different degrees of success. And one of the forms that brought me to all this was things like the Japanese haiku, which I studied, not in Japanese certainly, but in translation. At about the time when I was finding myself uncomfortable in the classic forms of English verse, again, not because there was anything wrong with those forms, but I simply was not able to employ them in a way that I found convincing. So I did, it's perhaps an old little haiku that's written vertically on the page. Birds in the city, snowfall on the ocean floor, which is sort of nice greeting card level verse, and that's about all. And then there are pattern poems of various kinds, different patterns of letters, again, basically on the typewriter grid. And I've used the typewriter as a kind of machine or lathe or saw to apply the letters on a page. I really do feel it in a very tactile sense using a typewriter. I've never learned to type in an automatic sense. I still only can type with one finger. But that made each operation of typing a very machine-like act, like actually embossing or applying a physical impression onto a page, almost as if I had a chisel and was making a cut or a die, making a mark on metal. Here is a board containing two laments. One is Lament for the Children, which is actually taken from a great bagpipe work, which was written in Scotland, I believe, at the end of the 16th century for one of the kings of Scotland, who I believe lost five or six children in a fire in one of his castles, and one of the great bagpipe compositions by his chief piper was Lament for the Children. And this is one reason I liked bagpipe music very much as I like drone music and the use of the drone. And this is a poem of repetition indeed, called 144 Times Lament for the Children. Each stanza is a stanza of six words, and the words are repeated finally in the last line all the way through, all the six words. So it's many repetitions of words, as is the next one, which is Lament on the Indian Wars, which is taken from a book, Indian History and Genealogy, which I discovered from a friend, actually, in the late 1950s. It was a book that had been published in the 19th century in the United States, in Massachusetts, to justify the claims of a woman who claimed Indian ancestry to the right to cut wood in the back lots of Massachusetts. And it was a book justifying the Indian cause in King Philip's War in 1675, which was the war fought between the Pilgrim Fathers, more or less, and the Indians of their neighborhood. And it was an absolutely devastating war for the Indians. The Indians were absolutely wiped out. But this is a lament. It begins, men, name, sun, men, face, red, head, face, men, name, men, chain, beads, neck, red, men, name, reins, and continues on for a number of pages. Nine pages, ending, mud, swamp, squaw, men, name, men, arms, years, sun, storms, men, white, bones. And a phrase from the book itself, which my poetry has probably never matched, from Indian History and Genealogy, was speaking of the Indians, that the living were too few to bury the dead, and their bones white, their bones lay bleached in the sun till whitening the localities of their former habitations, which was a great line. The next two sets of boards largely contain, in the horizontal format, dithyram again. There was a one-page dithyram upstairs, and this one again is an analysis of the four Gospels. I think in this case, different voices are given to different people. There would be, I believe, up to one, two, three, four, five or six columns of words, and they represent different voices, ideally to be voiced simultaneously in each column. This is a form which I've devised, which I call an opera. It is not actually to music, and none has ever been set to music, but it is for separate voices speaking, and the idea of voices crossing in words the way in opera different parts cross in music, also words, because the people are not speaking the same words. This kind of crossing of voices in lists of words is the reason why I call this form an opera. It's a misnomer, certainly, but it was something of the spirit I had in trying to compose this. So this is an opera on the diction of the four Gospels in, I think, five or six voices, and that goes on for a number of pages. I've done operas on different subjects. The first one I did was called Flags, and that was on the same subject as the one I previously referred to, which was de Kooning, Pollock, and Gorky. And Flags was assigning to each of three voices the analysis of the titles of their paintings, again with an alphabetical and word frequency analysis. And I've used that method on also another work, which is essentially autobiographical, which was taken from the map of Quinsy Bay, again to return to my own hometown, the islands and shores and rivers of Quinsy Bay, and the Blue Hills, which was the area immediately behind the city, and then the sky map overhead. So three voices were assigned to those. The last board contains the most recent works, which are, up to this time, everything has been done on a typewriter, but I've recently started to do work by hand printing on grid paper. And one of the difficulties I find is that these are all Xerox copies, and Xerox black and white copies on grid paper do not come out well at all because of the field of the grid. It falls away, that's all right, but it also affects the degree of reproduction of the words within the grid, because the values of the printed grid page and the handwritten letters are not at all close, so it's difficult to get a proper reproduction. But as you can see, these are again using the overall grid distribution, but in this case it is written by hand, and not with a typewriter, and on a paper which has already been ruled. The advantage, of course, of the typewriter is it rules itself by keeping a mechanically fixed portion. These are the, as I say, the most recent works, and I've continued. I'm really not sure whether I prefer the handwritten to the typewritten. It certainly has, to me, no difference in terms of whether I am the machine that puts down the words or the typewriter. It's the question of which one is more efficient producing the ends that I want to attain. Again, with word selection and by word length, and it's for one voice, and it's called Range from 1964. Ball, bead, seed, star, disc, hoop, lens, yard, hole, shoe, slot, moon, room, bell, gear, mass, wood, dome, kite, hall, heel, hook, rind, skin, arch, cone, hill, knob, leaf, roof, door, lace, root, seam, chin, edge, gate, knee, mile, neck, nose, rack, shin, wall, fork, grid, horn, road, rope, tree, foot, pole, tail, wing, path, beam, cord, line, rail, wire. And again, this is using a kind of line length, which perhaps was apparent in the reading. And I've never been able to do absolute nonsense poetry. And people may think that this poetry of mine is absolute nonsense, but I've never been able to use non-words or invented words or ersatz words. Other people have done that and attempt to make music out of language. But for me, my poetic interest in language is exactly the palpability, the tactile sense of the words themselves. And I've been accused of trying to treat words as things. Well, I know very well that words are not things, but words do have palpable, tactile qualities that we feel when we speak them, when we write them, and when we hear them or when we read them, and that's the real subject of my poetry.
And tell me, does that link up with your three-dimensional objects?
Well, the same person does both of them, indeed. All I know is that when there are words printed on the bricks, I always turn the words to the floor so the words cannot be read. All I can say is that the same person does both. And certainly my interest in elements or particles in sculpture is paralleled by my interest in words as particles of language. And in units which are different from sentences, grammatical sentences. Of course, words always have grammatical connection when they're placed together, if they're not nonsense words. But I have attempted to write poetry in which the sentence is not the dominant form, but the word is the dominant form. As you can see, there's a kind of split in the poetry, which is I've never really resolved, nor am I sure it ought to be resolved, which is between the visual aspect of the poetry and the sound aspect of the poetry, the aural, the A-U-R-A-L aspect. Poetry really was introduced to me as a child as sound, primarily. Even, of course, that's true with every child. The lullaby and 30 days has September, April, June, and November, the Memnonic verse, and so forth. But also, as I said before, about the visual aspect of books that I could not read, the books of poetry interested me. And I've only recently started to put the poems on the wall, that is, gluing Xerox copies of the poems directly onto the wall. And for the first time, I'm getting to see the poems beyond the range of legibility, which is a different question entirely. Of course, at that level, the words themselves function as if they were nonsense words, because you cannot read them. They're just too far away. My eyesight, at least, I cannot read them. So then they become a kind of pattern, almost as the poems were when I was a young child and could not read the poems. Now, I'm not at all saying that that is a desirable end. I would not, I think, compose poems of words where the words would just become patterns as they were in a painting. I'm not interested in that at all. But certainly the choice of words and the grouping of words has produced forms which have a, not an independent strength, but have a very apparent strength which comes from exactly the processes which caused the poem to be formed in the first place. Some of the poems are definitely meant to be sounded aloud. That is, the operas, and whether they're one-page operas or on to many pages is a long one, again from the conquest of Mexico. These have been performed privately, and a friend of mine in the state of Washington who performed with friends one of these operas pointed out to me, I think very wisely, that these operas really are not meant for anyone but the performers, because the interchange of the voices and the words between the dictions of the voices is not really so strongly apparent to someone listening to the performers as to the performers themselves doing it and being conscious of their own word stream counterpointing against another word stream. And I think it's absolutely true about that. I don't think that my work really lends itself to theater in any way. The last Saturday at Oxford at the Museum of Modern Art for the opening of my show there, I did do a reading of a work called False Creek, which is a 45-minute reading, and it's an analysis of a text of the life of a Canadian artist written by his mother. The Canadian artist committed suicide in 1969, and his mother wrote a memorial volume, which was published by Vanity Press in New York. And in that work, which is now exists entirely on file cards, I can't really imagine being done any way but in a reading. One starts with a large stack of file cards and reads the appropriate sentence or fragment and turns the file card over so that the large stack of file cards becomes the goes from the unread to the read stack, so that when people see it being read, they can be sure that it's coming to an end. I think it's very important somehow with works that we can be assured they are going to come to an end. I find myself in going to performances in galleries and museums that they seem to go on forever. And one thing I rather resent about the performance aspect of art is the fact that one feels embarrassed to walk out on works like that, whereas physical art objects, paintings and sculptures, and even these poems as they're on the wall, don't care at all if we walk away from them when we have lost interest in them. And I find a certain freedom with inanimate objects that sometimes is an embarrassment with actual performers. Performers make a much more intimate demand, I think, on our time and our attention, and we cannot bear to insult them by parting from them. But that's probably one reason why I have not been involved with the performance of works to a very great extent.
In the other room, you were talking about, you were interested in mapping poetry onto art.
Visual art, yes, in a sense. I, that's not a conscious plan, but you might say poetry classically, English poetry has classically been the mapping of language onto song and song forms, and we can accept that. That's very strong for the 17th century. It's with the 18th century, or perhaps with Dryden and his peers at the end of the 17th century. Then finally with Pope, we get a kind of poetry in the heroic couplet that is completely divorced from song entirely, and perhaps is mapped really on classical scholarship, which was just coming then into the university scholarship, was coming into the fore. And the Latin poets then became the model. But the irony of the Latin poets is that the English language doesn't have the same quantities at all that Latin has. So it was a mapping of one language, English, onto another language, Latin, that was so fundamentally different from English as if it were a different art form entirely. And forms like the heroic couplet and so forth emerged. Well, what my map is on the page, you might say. The page is an element, the printed page, the typewritten page, in some rare cases, the handwritten page. It's the visual aspect, because I think most people read poetry silently to themselves, and very few people sing poetry. And very few poets I know are musicians. Of course, that changed also in the 60s with people like Bob Dylan and with the rock musicians, the Beatles and so forth, were definitely poets who were musicians and composed the music and the poetry practically at the same time. Leads of the lyric leading to leads of the song and vice versa, which was something that had, I think, been lost for quite a while in common English practice. But that's something which is pretty much closed off to me, is that I'm not musical. I'm visual or tactile, even more than visual. I think I'm tactile. It's not the look of bricks that I like in my sculpture. It's their placeability, the fact that I can, as an individual, make a fairly large work by handling brick by brick, and can do it myself, and can compose a poem by combining words. If I can find the justifiable way to combine the words, and the justifiable way is not aesthetically justifiable in terms of a canon that pre-exists, but in terms of a convention which is sufficiently valid or strong to carry one from the beginning to the end, and at the same time assure us that the beginning was worth doing and the end was worth coming to. And whether I've succeeded in that is something that I will leave to others to decide. These examples we've been talking about now are fragments and attempts, and really represent different attempts at different forms. And that seems to be the state I'm in. I can't say that I have succeeded, but these are evidences of attempts.
What about your show at Oxford?
At the show at Oxford, there is a work called Still a Novel, which is on an incident in the life of Edward Muybridge. And it is approximately 97 pages long. And each page represents a kind of caption, as if a photograph had been taken by Muybridge of the event, which consists of his having shot his wife's lover and then having been exonerated by the jury for this crime. He was represented by the lawyer who also represented Governor Leland Stanford, the man who had commissioned Muybridge to take the photograph of the horse to find out if all the feet of the horse were ever off the ground at the same time. And this alliance of Muybridge, the photographer, with Leland Stanford, the patron and great financier and governor of the state and senator and so forth, managed to get him off in this rather dastardly crime, because he shot the man at night when he could not, when the Major Larkins, the unfortunate lover, could not even see if anyone was in the darkness. And Muybridge's claim, Muybridge's name, of course, actually was Muggeridge. He changed it in the course of his life to Muybridge when he was traveling from England to America, I believe. His claim was that he had not intended to kill Major Larkins, but only to maim him for life. And on that grounds, he was exonerated. However, this 97 pages represents a novel composed more or less as if they were captions of photographs that had been taken of the events described. And again, that was a convention of our age, which is the photographic caption is used to carry on a narrative in that case. I don't usually attempt narratives because it's a kind of logical plot line rather like the sentence, which I think is very well burdened and I don't feel too comfortable with. But that was definitely a traveling through, almost as if one was traveling through one of Muybridge's sequential photographs, except instead of the photograph, there is a caption. And that is more or less the structure of that. And there is also the color Xerox, which is a new process to England. I've used it myself in the United States recently, only this year, which gives a very strange embossed effect to color material. And the book, sort of scrapbook I did in 1960 called Passport, to which I referred before, is at Oxford in a color Xerox version, again pasted directly to boards on the wall. And I propose to give at Oxford and at the Tate, I think, in London, a narrative of Passport to explain why these pages were selected times. They're from books and works of art and so forth. They were in my possession in September 1960, and for some reason, some unconscious reason, not any particular design, I just gathered together excerpts of things that were around me at the time, and they do reflect my state of mind at the time and things that I was interested in then and perhaps no longer interested in now, and interests which continue, because I was then had reached the point of carving in sculpture when I had left carving, wood carving, behind and had started using separate elements. And it was a time of when I was going on to new things and leaving some old things behind. So Passport, in a sense, is a kind of my own visa stamp, I suppose, on my own progress as an artist and poet.
You seem to have a lot of interest in figures from American folklore that have currency, you know, popular heroes.
Some of them are popular heroes, but I think I usually get interested in them when their popularity is about dissipated. The fact that Lindbergh, for instance, is a perfect case of that. I don't think I would have been much interested in Lindbergh at the time of his great popularity, but he became a phantom of his own popularity. In the end of his life, he's recently died. He spent the latter part of his life devoted very much to preservation of wildlife, and I think finally he conducted himself with great dignity and learned very much not to make idle comments in public, ill-considered comments in public, and the causes that he finally did support toward the end of his life were the causes of conservation and ecology and things of that nature. I think it was exactly the state of this man after, you might say, his popularity had burned out entirely. And I am interested very much, perhaps coming from the city of Quincy, Massachusetts, which is unusually, as I said, steeped in history for our European transported history. It's quite unusual for a place in the English-speaking New World to have that 300 years of occupation alone, and it intertwines rather closely with American history, especially revolutionary history, and with the Adamses going into the history up to the Civil War and the questions of the abolition of slavery. And these essentially deal with problems that seem to recur, but with the passage of time, the figures of the past have a certain kind of fossilized clarity, you might say, an isolation, which things of the present time, I find it very difficult to bring any clarity to my vision of the present. Of course, the clarity of the vision of the past is completely artificial and false, but that's what I can deal with. I think I find it very difficult to deal with text in the present, though some of these poems have been composed, or some other poems have been composed of texts from the present. The usual text is either an historical document or the document of my own memory in cases of autobiographical material. But definitely the past has always interested me as my own past personally and the past of that which I have known.
So that the acts have almost become sort of archetypes, and though they soon lose their association or value in your work, you're interested, as you were saying earlier, in tactile qualities of words. They proceed from a point of being archetypes or...
Absolutely. In other words, yes, I may have unfortunately stripped these words of the associations which drew me to them to the first place, but definitely it was the associations which caused me to choose them, which is the opposite of the kind of random thing we were speaking of before. It's not by throwing dice that I arrive at these words, but perhaps if it now gives only the appearance of that, then it would be unfortunate, because then I would have defeated my own interest in the compositions.
And going on a bit, I think your attitudes about so-called conceptual art, which I think you feel very uneasy about.
Well, first of all, I am not in any sense an intellectual in the sense that conceptual art can be thought of as intellectual. My pleasure in art has always been the dialectic between the mind and the world. I think my temperament is such that it's much too easy for me to escape into mind or into idea, not on an intellectual level, but on the level of temperament or common thought, not in terms of organization. And so my poetry has allowed me to get away from reverie into concrete evidence of one kind or another. Perhaps the evidence is faulty, or not well organized, or unconvincing. But nevertheless, the evidence is in the world, and it is a dialectic between my subjective mental states and the physical possibilities in sculpture of materials, or the physical tactile properties of language itself, again, as writing, or as reading, or hearing, speaking. And it is exactly why, to me, art is not an art of ideas. An art of ideas, to me, is impossible for myself, and I think useless for myself, because ideas do not give me the pleasure that the dialectic between the mental state and the world state, that is what interests me very much, this passing between the two states, or the interplay between the two, but not ideas. As I've said many times, I do not have ideas in works of art. I have desires that I carry out or gratify to one degree or another, but they're not ideas that are realized in any platonic or linguistic sense.
So your work is located almost between the two polarities?
Well, the only absolute physical state would be the world or the universe without man at all, because as soon as we're aware of something, there is a dialectical relationship between our subjective mental state and of course, this is a delicate philosophical point. There are great arguments that there is no external state without the mental condition. I don't at all believe that. I'm a materialist. I'm sure that the sun would rise if man were never born, but it's exactly in that area of between the subjective and that which is enclosed in the mortality of oneself and the physicality of the world, and that's why I've said that art is a branch of agriculture, because it's exactly what happens when man sets out to cultivate a field. It's he must have a program and an intention and knowledge and all this mental preparation in order to make the field grow, but he must have the seed and he must have the field in a fertile condition and he must tend it and he must plow it and weed it, and then he must harvest it in its time, and that's an absolutely dialectical process. And I find exactly the same thing in art, which is between the states of memory and knowledge and the physical properties of the world.
Impressive. Wow. Really impressive.
Something
God,
else.
I never realized that Carl Andre had such a musicality and physicality to his voice.
No, me neither.
Just it pushed through all that other stuff so strongly. What did you think about it, Steve?
Well, you know, I've always felt conflicted about Carl Andre.
Right.
No small part because I think he probably did murder his wife, right?
Okay. Well, I guess you're entitled to your opinion.
Yeah, uh-huh. But I mean, it would be a first for us to have a murderer on the show.
I mean, that's a little harsh, Steve.
Our first murderer,
Steve.
Nick.
Come on, just eat your hot and ready and keep to yourself. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Thanks.
That was a really fun episode.
Woo.
We really hope you.